It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions. We'll take a look at how they did it and how the team and fans are celebrating. First, we've been hearing about the problem of loneliness for years. Almost 50 million Americans over the age of 45, especially men, suffer from chronic loneliness. The statistics are out there, but some people may not notice it as friendships slowly erode and loneliness starts to be a part of everyday life. Our next guest says he was in denial until he was assigned to write a story on loneliness in middle age. Now he's made a book out of his experience. Billy Baker is a staff writer for the Boston Globe. He talked to WPR's Keeley Boltina earlier this year about his new book, We Need to Hang Out, a memoir of making friends. Here's that conversation.
Let's use the way, way, way back machine. Before writing the book, kicked off by that reporting assignment, were you conscious of your growing loneliness or of people around you becoming lonely?
I think if I was feeling anything, it was that I was feeling like this is just how it is. You know, I was a middle-aged dad. I had two young boys. I had a wife. I had a career. And, you know, I had friends. I just wasn't seeing them. And it felt strangely like that's just how it was.
Those are reasonable things that take priority over friendship. And yet it's also like kind of an excuse that we just accept loneliness.
Loneliness in general, just even still hearing the word, it kind of clears the room. Like it makes me feel slightly uncomfortable to talk about. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, I would have never identified myself as lonely because I didn't want to think of myself in those terms. But when I got this assignment dumped on me, or when I get conned into this assignment, I realized, you know, it was time for me to raise my hand and realize I was the typical guy. And sadly, the typical guy was suffering from what science would call high loneliness.
Talk more about that.
Well, so I guess the easiest way is to start with the assignment. So I got called into an editor's office at the Boston Globe magazine with this idea that they had a story I'd be perfect for. Which is one of the oldest lies in journalism. And so I march down to the office and sit down. And I'm like, lay it on me. And this editor looks across his desk at me and says, I want you to write about how middle-aged men have no friends. And so in that moment, as I'm having this like existential crisis of like, why me? I have friends. What are we talking about here? The editor is laying all this data on me, the reason for the story, which is that there is this loneliness epidemic going on. It seems to be disproportionately affecting men. And even more startling was that it had these real dire consequences for not just your mental health, but your physical health. He starts laying this case that like every single thing you can think of that you don't want, cancer, heart disease, you know, diabetes, dying early, every single one of them is dramatically increased by not just being like chronically lonely, but being somewhat lonely. Even living alone greatly increases these chances. And, you know, when I initially got hit with this, my first thought was to try and get out of this assignment by rationalizing my way out and being like, I'm not perfect for this. I have plenty of friends. I don't know what you're talking about. But it really took just a short walk back to my desk to realize, you know, like as I started rattling through the names in my head of these people I think of as my best friends, it was like, I haven't seen that person in a couple of months. Like, I haven't seen that guy in years. Like, what happened? And what happened is a story that seems to be happening to all too many Americans nowadays.
Right. This distance kind of begins and then suddenly it's weeks and then suddenly it's months and you realize you haven't connected with people, especially, I mean, now we can't avoid the fact that you started this pre-pandemic. I mean, you took on this article, even this book before we were all told, hey, to stay safe, you need to keep your distance. How do you think the pandemic has affected loneliness or this lack of friendship? Considering all you figured out right before it happened.
I mean, I think there's no question it's exacerbated the problem, but I'm kind of a naive optimist where I'm hoping that we springboard out of this. Like it's a absence makes the heart grow fonder situation where we realize how important social connection was to us. And now we're willing to take action. I mean, I feel like since the pandemic arrived, I've heard from so many long lost friends with this, like, as soon as this is over, we need to get together, you know, and I hope that is true. You know, my book is called We Need to Hang Out, which is kind of a directive, but it's also references the idea that that's the sort of thing we say to each other a lot as adults, but how often does it happen? And this book really was about my journey to make it happen and to show how weirdly difficult it was to do that.
Billy Baker's a staff writer for the Boston Globe. His new book is called We Need to Hang Out, A Memoir of Making Friends. Springboarding off of what you just said, Billy, something that resonated with me was this description of waves of outreach from people. Like, you wrote the article, people reached out to you. You wrote a follow-up, and then you heard another wave of things. I feel like we don't have to write articles to experience that. You know, something happens in someone's life, terrible or wonderful, you share that news, and you generate this buzz in these conversations, and then slowly it just kind of creeps back to that silence again. Have you heard that from other people, or is it just me?
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something. I struggled for a while. So when I wrote the article, it became such a big viral hit that it felt like every person I'd ever met read it. And so in the original article, I kind of raised my hand and admit, you know, I've structured myself into being a little bit of a loser. I don't have any space in my daily life for friendship. And I mean, everyone I knew bent over backwards to reach out and say, oh, I always knew you were a loser, but we were connecting. And it was connecting in a nice way, because I feel like the ways it often happens are like, you know, it's at a funeral where you say, oh, we can't let this go on any further, you know. And so, you know, initially I write this article, becomes this weirdly viral hit. At the time, we believe it was the most popular article the Boston Globe had ever published, which just blew my mind. It was about male loneliness. And interestingly, it was surpassed by an article titled, Here's What Tom Brady Eats in a Typical Day, which I read. So it becomes this thing, and so many people are reaching out to me. And what was interesting was, you know, by raising my hand, I kind of created a safe space for other men to raise their hands, and women as well. But the reaction was never like challenging me on this evidence or wanting any more proof that there really was this cancer. It was more like, well, what's the cure? And it, in a weird way, it's like the easiest answer in the world, right? Like, the cure for loneliness is friendship. But actually making friendship a part of your life as an adult, it's what the book is about. It was this like comedy of errors. I went on these like journeys. At first, my natural reaction was to like get the band back together, to try and reconnect with friends from the past. I tried to reunite my high school class, some college buddies, and I had some success. But ultimately, I realized that if I really wanted to have, you know, the benefits that come with friendship, what I needed to do was to build friendship into my daily life. And I'm someone who, I think a lot of people in America are in this category now, I no longer live where I grew up. You know, I'm in a new community. And so I had to do one of the most awkward things there is to do, which is to try and make new friends. Or in my case, to kind of convert acquaintances into friends, because I think I was guilty of thinking this would just happen naturally. You know, I'm a parent, I'll meet the other dads on the sideline at the game, and we'll grab a beer or whatever. But like, everyone was kind of, it seemed, locked into the same, you know, cycle of commitments, where that those beers were few and far between. Those weekends when you say you're going to get away, they're few and far between. But to actually, you know, get all these benefits that science tells us you can get from friendship, you need to have friends. You need to have a way to be friends with your friends. And so that's what the journey was really about, trying to figure out what that is. And ultimately, I started using this phrase. I called them velvet hooks, which was to try and find these things that can connect you, a way to an activity that allows you to be friends with your friends. And, it, you know, the word velvet is nice because it's like soft. No one wants another ironclad commitment. And we know what these things are, right? They're like the weekly book club, or the weekly, you know, adult sports league, or the fantasy football league, whatever it is. I just needed to find those with each of the people that I really wanted to connect with.
You're listening to a conversation with writer Billy Baker. He talked to WPR's Keely Boltina earlier this year about his latest book, We Need to Hang Out, A Memoir of Making Friends. We'll hear more of that coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue listening to a conversation about men and friendships. WPR's Keely Boltina talked to writer Billy Baker about his book, We Need to Hang Out, A Memoir of Making Friends. We heard from Marcus in Milwaukee. Here's what he had to say.
So I'm 41, and I personally feel like what I've observed is is that with, you know, like couples, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, it's usually historically been left to the female to kind of be the social planner per se. And so like when that part is removed, I've noticed that as men age, they just lose that because they haven't been active in taking part in that, you know, in terms of staying in contact with people. I also feel like that society, to a certain extent, looks at men as like, you know, we're supposed to be tough, we're supposed to be independent, so we feel like we should not be relying on others as much. And then also that with that being part of it, it's also kind of touchy-feely, you know, and I'm not saying that I believe this, but it seems like that's kind of historically been the precedent, that it's like, you know, like reaching out to say I'm lonely or I miss you as a man, it's like, no, you're supposed to be tough, but, you know, buck up and...
Yeah, Marcus, thanks so much for bringing that up, because I think it's a really important point here. Billy, what do you hear as Marcus is saying, I think society expects men to not need other people?
I mean, it's 100% true. It's there's this strange soloist idea, this idea of kind of being this man's man, keeping a stiff upper lip. But, you know, it's friendship is something that falls in the same, you know, category as a romantic relationship. You know, for it to mean something, there has to be some vulnerability there. And that's just something that men are just raised to avoid. You know, it's a sign of weakness. You know, as I went on this journey, ultimately, I had to make myself vulnerable in the most awkward ways, like really embarrassing things that I tried to set up. And I have to say that one of the beauties of getting old is that in each case, that vulnerability was rewarded. You know, but that doesn't mean it's easy for people at, you know, younger stages in life. And, you know, there's definitely problems here. I mean, there's issues of being shouted down as, you know, being feminine or weak or whatever it might be. If you do show any sort of like emotional honesty, male to male.
And even now, you know, you're saying you had to go through some embarrassing things, like they still feel embarrassing to you.
Oh, God. I mean, what I ultimately ended up doing was trying to start like a Wednesday night fraternity. Like I got to this point in my journey where, you know, I would look out the window and be like, you know, I've done a lot of work, but I still don't have anyone to hang out with on a Wednesday night. So I tried to start this club that, you know, like a boys club that meets in a barn. It was the simplest thing in the world, but I invited a bunch of guys and I went, got there a little early, and I sat in that barn, and it was like I was back in sixth grade again, like afraid to walk into the school dance, like the nerves, that I mean, vulnerability is the only word for it. Like I felt like I'd, you know, I could have been walked all over, but it didn't happen. And I think it's because, it, you know, in every case when it's like I reach out to an old buddy, say, I miss you, we should hang out, like, they're thinking the same thing. It's just for some reason we've been trained to think that that's just not a thing to do. You know, not in every case, but it was a barrier in a lot of my friendships. And thankfully, those barriers are falling. The more I'm willing to say, hey, I kind of screwed this up and I want to get this straight.
You've done so much reaching out, put so much intention into inviting people to do things with you. Honestly, it sounds exhausting. Is it tiring? I mean, is it worth it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the person I am at the end of this journey, and as opposed to where I began, it's hard to, like, I feel like I'm faking it a little bit as I'm doing these publicity rounds and talking about, like, this lonely person that I was, because I don't feel that way anymore. And it was about, like, I mean, the book, you know, I got this assignment, I delved into the science, I pulled out a lot of this really fascinating stuff, and then I basically used it in a selfish way. I tried to hack my own life and fix some things. And there were so many things that were like so illuminating. Like one that's very important that I kind of want to get out there is that when science studies the way people interact, there's a clear difference in the ways that men interact versus the way women interact. And women talk face to face and men talk shoulder to shoulder. And this is known from these things called photo studies, where a sociologist kind of creep around and take pictures of us unawares, interacting. And when you analyze them, it's there. And when we think about that idea of shoulder to shoulder, it goes back to this idea that men tend to bond over an activity. And it's why sometimes I think, you know, before all this, when I'd see an old friend and we'd say we should get together to get some coffee or something like that, it didn't sound all that appealing. But if the same person had said, hey, do you want to come over and help me chop down this tree in my backyard? Like, I would have been there at 6 a.m. Like, I was using the science to, like, hack my friendships, and it worked. You know, this book is, if I'd have to describe it anyway, it's like a comedy. It's watching some guy just comically fail over and over until ultimately I kind of use the tools of science the science of loneliness to hack the code of friendship in some ways, or at least for me.
Billy Baker is a writer who's got a new book out about his experiences maintaining friendships. And we're taking your calls on this at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have enough friends? Do you feel like you are connected? Where do you think we fall short when it comes to creating and maintaining friendships? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We've got Mike from Sun Prairie on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hey, have you ever studied this in former GIs?
Why do you ask, Mike?
Well, because it seems like we have a tendency to get together and hoop it up, but it generally involves a little bit of beer and foolishness and lying. And the other thing is that the wives aren't all that fond of it. So
the wives aren't all that fond of it. I got you, Mike. Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, Mike here bringing up saying veterans tend to hang out better with each other. We also had Mark from Fort Atkinson call who said that there are positive effects of organized religion on this and that church creates a sense of community. So there are things or experiences that do bond us, Billy.
Oh, there are definitely things that work, and it's a matter of like going to them. And if you have a tribe, nurture it. If you don't have one, you have to find one or create one. And I think that was ultimately what I realized was I just didn't have active membership in a tribe. And to go back to the idea of soldiers, there's a great book by Sebastian Younger, who's famous for writing the book The Perfect Storm. But he spent a few years as a war correspondent, came home and found that he was kind of miserable. And that he had been happier in these dire circumstances and started delving in that issue for veterans in general. And it was found that a lot of them, you know, the PTSD and all these issues were based on their feeling of loss of a tribe, of being necessary to others. So it's wonderful to hear that, you know, I mean, as the caller said, beer and lying and acting like juveniles, that seems to work for men across the board. But it's great to hear that, you know, former GIs are getting together and doing these things because, you know, we know from surveys that, you know, when you ask a man, when did you make your best friends? They're invariably going to say like childhood or school or military service or sports, these places where you're going through something together with others. Those are the things that just disappear as we get into adulthood. So really, to get back on the right track, it's about finding those things to continue to go through with others again.
Bob in Coconacald couldn't stay with us. Bob said that once in a while, Bob looks through the phone, sees the name of an old friend, and just calls them. And they always thank Bob for calling when they're done chatting. That sounds like one of those things that you just put forth the effort and try, even though Bob says his kids make fun of him for it.
It's funny, the phone has a weird stigma amongst men. Some are good at it, but, you know, again, we know from the science that women are able to maintain deep friendships over the phone, but men struggle with that. And so I have a few guy friends that are great about picking up the phone. I'm trying to become better, but I have to admit, there's something for me that about 30 seconds into a phone call, I'm like, all right, I'll see you later, even if that later is years from now. You know, I'd much rather put something on the calendar and get together than I don't know, talk over the phone. There's something about it where I think I'm envious of those who can do that.
Right. And how much you wind up, you know, really developing trust with someone, because friendship has to be based on trust. And if you can't see their face, or if you can't really gauge them from afar, that makes it really difficult. Mike in Algoma is on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I've got a couple comments. One is that over the years, I've come up with a philosophy that to have friends, you've got to be a friend. Reach out, and hopefully who you're reaching out to recognizes it and reciprocates. The second thing is that I think the internet has really screwed up relationships. It used to be that you'd have to pick up the phone to talk to somebody or else go to their house. Then we had emails, and you could email things like, yeah, it was good talking with you the other day, and I hope we can get together again. And then with messaging, now all you got to do is hit a little emoji, and it's thumbs up or okay or something like that, and that's the end of the conversation.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for bringing up those points. I want to make sure our guest has a chance to get to it. Billy, what do you think of Mike's assessment?
Oh, I mean, the social media is the big question. And the science at the moment is kind of caught in a chicken and the egg situation where we know people who spend a lot of time on social media are lonelier, but we don't know if that's why they're going to social media. But I've yet to meet a person who doesn't feel in their gut that there's something sort of wrong with the whole thing. And so I, as part of this journey to test it out, I got rid of all my social media. And sure enough, it eliminated, you know, these sort of shortcuts in the sense where I would see a friend, we'd have to catch up, I'd have to hear what's going on, rather than maybe I had a Cliff's Notes version of their life. And it also eliminated those like minor annoyances where I might be upset with someone because of their politics or some statement they made or whatever it might be. It feels like, you know, when we get together in a room with people, we're much more likely to get along and to be kind of yes and in the conversation than to be sort of divisive or, you know, black and white. And so for me, social media was something I said goodbye to, and I don't ever see myself going back.
Hmm. Billy, thanks so much for telling us so much about yourself and about what you found through writing this book. It's been really interesting, this conversation. Thanks for your time.
Hey, this was fun. Thanks for having me.
That was Billy Baker. He's a staff writer for the Boston Globe. He talked to WPR's Keely Boltina in February about his new book, We Need to Hang Out, a memoir of making friends. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about the lessons learned on a family camping trip.
Taking the kids camping usually sounds like a great idea, until it's not. Author B.J. Hollers brings us a story about the trials and triumphs of the family camping trip.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. With those famous words, Charles Dickens opened his classic novel, which, if you read no further, might very well be a book about camping. Ah, camping, the foolhardiest of summer traditions. The chance to dust off the tent, unfurl the sleeping bags, and pretend that you enjoy the outdoors. And all the better if you actually do. And we did, at least for a little while, as my children and I pulled into our campsite at Coon Fork Campground 30 miles east of Eau Claire. Standing at the edge of our site, we peered out at the glistening 62-acre lake, while overhead the birds welcomed us with song. My 8-year-old son shimmied beneath my left arm, my 6-year-old daughter took refuge beneath my right. Together, we all inhaled a gallon-sized breath of cool Wisconsin air. It was the best of times, indeed. Right up until the storm struck a few hours later, sending us speeding back to the comforts of our home. Warm beds never felt so good. Returning to our site the following morning, I was relieved to find that the weather gods had taken pity on us. Our tent had not become a houseboat as I'd feared, merely a waterbed. No matter, it was nothing 10 absorbent towels couldn't fix. Our return to Coon Fork the morning following the storm came with an added challenge. Our 9-month-old baby, who was destined to enjoy her first day of camping while my wife went off to work. Perhaps enjoy is too strong a word. Maybe endure is more accurate. Which she did, suffering little more than a forehead scrape after a topple from the cooler while Daddy extinguished an unplanned cookstove fire that had scorched our lunch. Best of times, indeed. When my wife and the puppy pulled into our campsite at day's end, she witnessed a scene pulled not from the pages of Dickens, but William Golding's Lord of the Flies. We were scraped, sunburned, hungry, tired, and trapped in a soggy tent. "How's it going?" she asked. The baby wailed. Sometime after midnight, I woke to the sound of my wife searching frantically in the dark for a diaper. We searched by cell phone glow as the baby's discomfort grew. "I think one's in the van," my wife whispered. Untangling myself from my sleeping bag, I high-stepped over the snoozing puppy, tripped on the lip of the tent, had a run-in with some overly confident raccoons, and at last retrieved the diaper as directed. Then I reversed course. past those raccoons, over the tent lip and atop the snoozing puppy. Proudly, I handed the diaper to my wife. "And the wipes?" she asked. I sighed. After that second trip to the van, I lingered on the edge of that star-filled lake stretched before me, listening to the nighttime serenade from insects I probably couldn't name. It wasn't the sound, but the stillness that stays with me, a stillness that seemed to neutralize the many mishaps that had compounded throughout the day. I took in one last gallon-sized breath before returning to the tent, where, upon entering, I saw my entire world snoozing safely together, a pile of legs, arms, and stuffed animals all woven together. I reached for my sleeping bag, only to find that the puppy had since commandeered it as his own. Well played, dog. Well played. Finding a spot on the tent's damp floor, I reached for a towel, closed my eyes, and took my place in the pile. It was the best of times, indeed.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, the last time the Milwaukee Bucks were NBA champions, Richard Nixon was president, a new home cost a little more than $28,000, and a first-class stamp was 8 cents. The year was 1971, but last night, the drought came to an end.
Tucker with the rebound. The Suns are not going to foul. It's been a 50-year journey. Wisconsin, we've got a room at the top of the world tonight. The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions. Let the celebration begin.
The voice of Ted Davis, the voice of the Bucks, in front of more than 17,000 fans at Five Serve Forum in downtown Milwaukee, and an estimated 65,000 more outside in the Deer District. The Bucks beat the Phoenix Suns in Game 6, 105-98. Giannis Antetokounmpo continued his legendary postseason performance, scoring 50 points, throw in 14 rebounds and 5 blocks. No surprise, he's the Finals MVP. Bucks president Peter Fagan says the big celebration will happen tomorrow with the championship parade, something that didn't happen when they won it last time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How excited are you about the Bucks and their championship? What's your favorite thing about the team? Were you at the game, in the arena or the Deer District? Have you been a longtime fan, or did you join in this year? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. J.R. Radcliffe is a sports reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers social stories and trending local sports topics. J.R., welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, here's a trending local sports topic. I imagine you and your colleagues have been pretty busy the last 24 hours or so.
Yeah, it's been something. I told my wife's out of town, and I just talked to her on the phone and said, "Oh, I remember to water your flowers here at 4 o'clock." It was the first time I had left my house because I was downtown until wee hours of the morning, and then I've been just working on stuff pretty much since we got home. There's a lot of angles and a lot of just incredible stories to tell. So I've got some great colleagues, and everybody's been really hard at work.
Now, you've been in Wisconsin for a while now. You've covered the Bucks. What's it like now to see them at the top after they were darn near the bottom not that long ago?
Yeah, it obviously takes some getting used to. This is, and I had tweeted this last night, it's actually the first time we've had a Milwaukee sports team win, at least for Major League Baseball and the NBA, the two big leagues win on home soil. The two other times this has happened, in 1971, the Bucks won in Baltimore, and in 1957, the Milwaukee Braves won in New York. So even for the rare person in Milwaukee, the 20% of you who remember the 1971 Bucks title, that were here then, you know, there's been nothing like this. This is so unprecedented. And the Bucks really committed to this rebuild back in 2013 when Giannis Antetokounmpo was a rookie. Chris Middleton was on the team in his first year. They knew they were bad. They took some lumps because they played guys that they, you know, some veterans that weren't going to be here for very long, but also it was an opportunity for Giannis to get his feet wet. And the rapport that the two of those players ended up building over time became kind of the central rock behind the Bucks' success. So The last 3 years, there's been some heartbreak, but some obvious market improvement where they're one of the best teams in the NBA. And now they've taken this this next step. It's pretty great to be a Milwaukee sports fan right now.
Talking about the Milwaukee Bucks championship win last night. J.R. Radcliffe is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You could join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on last night's game, on the season, off on the playoff run, on the Bucks rags to riches rise over the last 7 years. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. JR, let's talk about Giannis Antetokounmpo and his performance last night. Giannis, I don't think this is just like a hometown pride thing, right? This postseason run for him is going to be a thing of NBA legend. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. I mean, to score 50 points like he did in a clinching game is the stuff that honestly legends are made of. That Jordan, you know, Michael Jordan, it's that level of performance. 33 points in the second half. I believe Jordan's the only other player to have done that. And it came on a night sort of the supplementary stars, Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday, were struggling on offense, and he put the team on his back, you know, and his knees, the knee that just a couple weeks ago looked like it had sustained an injury that he would never be able to come back from, and let alone play at this level. I mean, he had something in every one of these games. Game one, just coming back, was amazing in the NBA Finals. Just having him on the floor was unexpected, and he put up great numbers, not as normal scoring output, but still very, very good. Game two, he scores 40 points in a loss. Game three, he goes back-to-back 40-point games that had only been done, I believe, two other times maybe, in NBA Finals history. He then authors one of the greatest blocks in NBA history in game four, a game-saving block. He's on the finishing end of an alley-oop that'll be played for years in Milwaukee on highlight reels from Drew Holiday. That's game five. And then game six, he still has something left in the tank to stun us all. He has a tremendous individual effort, 50 points, 14 rebounds, hits almost all his free throws, which is very rare for him. 17 of 19 from the free throw line, 5 blocks. I mean, the guy was everywhere. He was a singular force of nature. The type of stuff you can only dream of having if you're a small market franchise, and they've got him now, and they've got him for the next 4 years at least. And he's going to be one of the great. I mean, he is one of the greatest athletes in Milwaukee sports history. He may have a case to be the greatest. It's really impressive.
And JR, I got to say, if I was like a Hollywood script writer and my first draft says, the star gets hurt in games in the semifinals, we don't know if he's going to come back. Oh, but then he comes back, the team holds it together, and then he has this. I would throw it away. Too much of a cliche.
Too on the nose,
that doesn't
right?
really happen, right?
And that's just the on the court stuff. I mean, it's such a fairy tale story. Him coming, you know, born to Nigerian immigrants in Greece and a family having to scratch and claw for everything they could get. He's this raw sort of undiscovered talent. He's drafted as a teenager, brought to Milwaukee at 18, 19 years old, a guy who's just so raw, and they couldn't have possibly known what they had with him, not just as a player, but as sort of an ambassador. Like, he's gone viral a couple times this week for some of the quotes he's had, some of the just really interesting moments of introspection. Great sense of humor. He was driving through a Chick-fil-A this morning, getting chicken nuggets, ordering 50 chicken nuggets in honor of his 50 points with the NBA championship, the Larry O'Brien trophy, and his NBA Finals MVP trophy in the car with him. Like, he just gets it. He's having a great time. He's youthful and yet seemingly, you know, very mature with just incredible insight. There's no way they could have foreseen what they had in him as a player in person. He's just blossomed before Milwaukee's eyes. You know, how do you not fall in love with a guy like that? It is truly a fairy tale story. It's going to be a movie on Disney Plus. So, like, even Disney knows what they have with this. And now what an amazing next chapter here.
We're celebrating the Milwaukee Bucks' first NBA championship in 50 years with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sports reporter J.R. Radcliffe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does it feel to be a Bucks fan today? Do you have a Giannis jersey on right now? Do you have a favorite memory of this season, this playoff run? Do you have a favorite Bucks memory of all time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We are talking about the newly crowned NBA champions, Milwaukee Bucks, with J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers trending local sports topics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your favorite moments, your comments, your thoughts on this championship. 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hi. I'm a bandwagon basketball fan, but I'm all fans Wisconsin, anything to do with Wisconsin. But what really captured me about this team is watching them play and their work ethic. They're just outworking everyone. I think that reflects what Wisconsin is kind of all about, and we didn't have to go out to purchase these or buy these supermarket players. We were able to draft, develop, bring in a few pieces, and really just through hard work, grit, and determination, we were able to get the job done. I think that is something that a lot of Wisconsinites can relate to and aspire to.
John, thanks a lot for the call. JR, what do you think? The Bucks a good match for Wisconsin, and I think Milwaukee in particular.
Yeah, particularly guys like on the fringes of this rotation, like PJ Tucker and Bobby Portis, really blue collar guys, brought in newcomers to the Bucks. Portis obviously became sort of a fan favorite here. There's this love affair right now between Milwaukee and Portis, who's such a high energy, work hard guy. PJ Tucker, a veteran, a gritty guy. And going back to Giannis, just the insatiable desire he has to get better and better and better. He always talks about it. He never takes anything for granted. And that has been his MO from day one. It's why he's gotten to where he is. You got an understated guy in Chris Middleton, Drew Holiday, another newcomer who immediately got into the community and started doing great things and is just a brilliant mind and a fascinating guy. And yeah, it's such an easy team to root for. There's no one on this team who's, you know, is a guy who's just like chasing a ring or whatever, who's got, you know, maybe he already has one, or there's no one on this team that's difficult to root for. And really the Suns were like that too, to a degree, but this Bucks team, a lot of people nationally love them too.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Owen in Madison. Owen, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Owen, what did you want to talk about?
Well, you know, I've been a Bucks fan for my entire life to this point, you know, and it's great to see the fact that they were able to progress. They found their identity a couple of years ago against the Raptors, but came up a little bit shy when it comes to talent around Giannis. So the past couple of years, just building it up, getting these guys like Bobby Portis, who everyone loves, PJ Tucker, great defender, is able to be like that kind of guy for them. And obviously Drew Holiday, who was two-way player, led them. I mean, he had more assists than Chris Paul. It's crazy to see how the Bucks team have went from the bottom dwellers in the NBA to now on top.
Oh, and thanks a lot for that call. And that reminds me, JR, I keep seeing people pulling up quotes from Giannis and from Bucks organization people in those darker days talking about, we don't want to just be a good team, we want to be champions. Giannis talking about taking it, his goal was to win an NBA championship. Did people really take that seriously as they were saying that?
Maybe not when he was younger, but as he got better and better, and the big question mark was, would he sign that Supermax extension before the season, which he ultimately did, of course. And a lot of speculation that a guy like that would want to test the waters and want to play for a big market out west or out east, or, you know, put himself in the best position possible to win a championship, which ironically enough turned out to be Milwaukee, which he knew. And he said all along, every piece of evidence we had was he loved it here. He wanted to stay here. He was a humble guy. He appreciated the small town vibe, the family atmosphere. And then he backed it up by signing on the dotted line. He's going to be here for another 4 to 5 years. And, you know, he led this team to a title. So that, yeah, he's backed it up, everything he said. And, we're believing him now. He's a champion, an NBA champion.
Oh, and thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about the Bucks championship with J.R. Radcliffe from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Before we run out of time, J.R., I want to give a listen to a song that I understand you're kind of keen on. Here's a listen to Got Bucks Lust by Eddie Lemberger.
Got Bucks Lust. I love my Milwaukee Bucks. Got Bucks Lust. Got Bucks Lust.
There's the gist. Eddie Lemberger, who I understand wrote the I Love My Green Bay Packers back in the 90s. What's the story here?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I had a chance to talk to him a few weeks ago. He's an artist and he's done a few songs. He's done a lot of songs, but the ones that really caught on, of course, were I Love My Green Bay Packers back in the day. And now this one, and he was a big believer that if the Bucks just heard his song, if his song caught on, it would ignite something. It would give the Bucks an opportunity to win the title. And I don't know how much I believe that, but he turned out to be right. So this is a lot of songs popping up, a lot of different genres represented. I think is pretty cool. It's just you saw that with the Packers in their Super Bowl runs. It's just a sign of the enthusiasm that people have for this team. And so that one, Got Bucks Lust, is going to live forever. I'm not sure how comfortable everyone will be with that, but it's going to be here a while.
It's kind of a hard phrase to say, Got Bucks Lust. I don't know. Yes. Maybe, though. Who am I to judge?
It's an earworm. It gets in your head, though.
So, Jay, I got to ask, what does this mean for Milwaukee? As you mentioned, Midwestern, you know, smaller market by big sports standards. We're used to that, you know, with successful Green Bay teams. What does this mean for Milwaukee?
Well, there's obviously an economic impact. There's the... I'm sure the Bucks will benefit greatly. There's going to be renewed interest in their team. It's going to be a lot harder to get a ticket than it has been in years past. And I think from their perspective, it's knowing now that they've won a title that you can do it. You can win a title in a small town by, you know, relatively speaking, that's going to be attractive to other players who want to win a championship and maybe will consider playing in Milwaukee, where they previously would have closed that door in their mind, because it's a cold city. You know, the NBA season goes through the winter. That's not something a lot of players want to deal with. So that's obviously a benefit, and it just looks really good for the town to have that unity, to have people coming together, 65,000 strong downtown, just outside the building, watching that team win a championship. I mean, it's a credit to the sports community that exists here. A lot of Brewers fandom as well, and they're having a good season. So it's just good vibes in Milwaukee. And I know there's just a ton of enthusiasm right now for the Milwaukee Bucks.
And I want to wrap up. Immer wrote on our website about the article, "Congratulations, Milwaukee, a long time coming. And as a longtime St. Louis Cardinal fan, if the Cardinals can't do it, I hope the Brewers can. What do you think? 2 JR championships in a year. Am I getting greedy here?
Oh yeah, greedy, but why not? Why not shoot for the stars? You got one in the pot, you know, one in your hands. Let's do 2. I think this Brewers team is set up for a lot of really good postseason outlook. They've got pitching that they've never had before. Even the teams that made the postseason have never had anything like this on the pitching front. And their offense has some question marks, but you get to the postseason, all those games end up being really tight, 1-run, 2-run games. And they've got the horses to do that. So I would absolutely not rule that out. It might seem high in the sky. They've never haven't been to the World Series since 1982. But, you know, this maybe the stars are just really aligned here in Milwaukee.
JR, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That's JR Radcliffe, sports reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we talked to them about the Milwaukee Bucks and the end of their 50-year wait to win another NBA championship. Parade, by the way, downtown Milwaukee set to begin tomorrow at 11 in the morning, followed by a celebration in the Deer District.